so I'm back with Greg Dykstra from Pixar Studios, and we're going to carry on with the conversation we were having last time. So the one thing I'm really interested in, Greg, is as a creative person, I mean, obviously as a production studio, you run to a timetable, and when a film is released and you're already working on the next thing, does it kind of feel like you're revisiting the past a little bit? Or, you know, is it difficult for you to watch the films once you've actually gone through that creative process of making them when you've already moved on to the next thing?
We are very critical. So most of the time when a film is done, a lot of us here still wince at a few things, and we still, you know, wish that we could do this or that a little bit better. But I think that's a good thing because we learn from that, and we build on that, and we progress as we go forward, and it's what we all want to do. I think we kind of have to have that desire to just, I don't want to use it because it's so used so often, but we always want to push the envelope, not just in terms of technology, although that's a big thing too, but just in general, the look, the feel of the film, and how it makes us feel, how it made audiences feel. So I wouldn't call it difficult to look at, though. I actually, and I know there's a lot of people who I've heard a lot of actors say that they can't watch their own films. I'm not quite like that. I really enjoy seeing our past work because there's a whole lot of memories tied into that. And also it's a good way to see how far we've come.
Yeah, it must be interesting having that sort of audience association of, oh, I remember doing this bit, I remember doing that bit. It must be, you know, almost like a picture book in a way, you know, like a family album of going through these films.
Yeah.
And that must be sort of an interesting thing. And obviously that the software that a lot of the software you work with is the RenderMan software. And I'm quite interested from the point of view of, obviously, Blender is another one that sort of ended up evolving into an open source sort of thing. What's your mm-hmm. viewpoints on things like Blender and sort of stuff like that, the open source equivalents of like RenderMan and things?
I'm really intrigued about it. I don't know where it will go, but I love the idea of that shared technology and making, you know, making it available to more people. There's, you know, when I was a kid and interested in getting into film, even getting, you know, we grew up in kind of a poor family. I mean, we didn't have a lot of stuff. It was hard to get things like movie cameras and stuff, and our school actually would lend us things, and that was really helpful. But having a Super 8 camera to start making films was really important, and it was a big part of my development, I think, just starting to realize that I could do this stuff, that I wanted to do it, that it was exciting, and just start the early development process for how your brain would kind of solve problems, you know, just your normal training ground, young training ground. So anyway, I think that if the young people today could have easy access to things that are give them much more power, basically, than those little Super 8 cameras. I mean, the power to edit and, you know, add sound effects and add effects and, you know, modify footage that they've shot or do animation, you know, directly into the computer and keep advancing. I mean, all of that stuff is just, it's amazing. And I think if we didn't have something like Blender, it restricts people from doing that work, that kind of work and that kind of experimentation. It would restrict them based on the money that's involved to get that stuff, or it would restrict them from experimenting until they got into, you know, some college, you know, program that would allow them to, you know, start experimenting with these things. And I think it's much healthier, much more rewarding, and ultimately you'll get a better result if people can explore this stuff on their own without any guidance, at least prior to doing it in school.
So it's creating a free-form foundation almost, you know, where they can just have their creative juices sort of flowing through these things, so to speak, learning through doing.
Yeah, yeah. And that, you know, I didn't go to college for the work that I do. I in no way would not recommend it, though. I think college is excellent, and I think people should go to school, you know, film schools, and really get the exposure, especially to a lot of different people with different ideas. I mean, that's one of the most exciting things about working for a studio, like Pixar is that you can you are exposed to lots of people with different ways of thinking and different disciplines and different strengths, and it's very, you know, it's very electrifying. It's really great. So I definitely think people should be going to school and figuring this, you know, learning this stuff in that kind of an environment. But I do think that both are important, and I think your ability to explore and learn on your own is really important. And I think that something like Blender gives people that opportunity in a way that's never happened before.
Okay. Now, an interesting and convenient transition into the next thing I want to talk about, which is your other venture, which is Paleo Mill, is a few years ago, you had a photograph on your back wall of a dinosaur, and you've got The Good Dinosaur coming out next year, I believe. To touch more on that is, how did you get into Paleo Mill, and explain to people what Paleo Mill is?
Well, we're still trying to figure out what Paleo Mill is, but what it is it's a company that I set up in order to scan dinosaur skeletons and to make 3D prints from them. And the company exists as a way of us making it hopefully one day self-sustaining, because we're just in love with dinosaurs, and we want to help paleontologists. And we want to find ways to replicate those dinosaurs so that, you know, if you have, you know, a 40-foot long T-Rex with a, you know, 5-foot long skull, you obviously can't bring that to your home, but you could bring, you know, a smaller version of that, you know, like a 6-inch skull, you know, and hold it in your hands and examine it and enjoy it, you know, and it's an exact replica of what you saw in the museum. So that company was formed a few years ago in order for us to just start to go down the road of allowing a lot of paleontologists to have access to digitizing their collections, and hopefully ultimately will help with research, and then on a consumer level, hopefully it'll help to inspire people to want to learn more about them or to make study easier.
I mean, having tread the boards between the commercial and the research world, a lot of the misconception most of the time is, particularly when you're working with sort of 3D imaging or reality capture sort of technologies, is that everybody knows about it, but they really don't. And so I think it would be interesting to sort of like ask you, what are paleontologists on a day-to-day basis actually using at the moment to normally record and sort of study, you know, fossil records and things like that?
Well, even though the scanning technology is beginning, to make its way into paleontology and other branches of science, you're absolutely right that it's pretty. People might be stunned to learn, you know, how little it is used and how little is known about it, and paleontology specifically has mostly relied on photographs and hand-drawn descriptions, basically, of the skeletons. So they'll be very detailed, very beautiful, by the way, hand-drawn drawings that were done back in the 1800s and all the way up until fairly recently. And that was the way that the paleontologist could measure the bone against the drawing and kind of account for any distortion that would happen in a photograph. All photography, has this distortion that happens in the lens, this foreshortening, so the further away, you know, a form is from the camera, it's going to be smaller, obviously, and the closer it is, it's going to be larger. Mm-hmm. The problem is that if you're working with, you know, some bone that has this kind of three-dimensional space, then something that's close to you is going to appear to be larger if you're trying to take measurements from it. And even if you match that to the piece, if you measure any forms that occur just a little bit further back in space, they have shrunk with the distance. And so if you do this scientific drawing, you can make sure that everything is the right measurement. And basically that is something that scanning can help with, because you can create a completely orthographic image, and it's something you can only do in the computer, and so you can have a very accurate scan, and you can basically flatten that scan so that it doesn't have